Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. This one is beginning our brand new series in Hosea, and it is entitled Hosea and History. So we are going to be discussing Hosea chapter 1, verses 1 to 9. And before we get there, I'd like for you to think about a question that I'd like to ask you, and that question is this. Imagine that someone told you God will speak to you later today. The question I'd like for you to think about is, if God spoke to you today, what do you think God would say? What would God tell you? What words would God use? Because Hosea is a book in which God speaks to the author, Hosea, and says words. So with that in mind, let's turn to Hosea 1, 1-9, because what God says to Hosea is surprising and is very different than the answer I would give to the question, what would God say to me today if God spoke to me? So with that in mind, let's read Hosea 1, 1-9. We read, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, in the days of kings Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah of Judah, and in the days of King Jeroboam, son of Joash of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea," and God speaks to Hosea. These are the words that God has chosen. God says, "Go, Hosea, take for yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." Now understand what is happening here. Hosea, who believes that he is a prophet of God, hears God's voice. And the very first sentence that God says to Hosea involves the word whoredom, not once, not twice, but three times. Three times in one sentence, God uses the word whoredom. This is not what I picture God saying to me. I don't know what you pictured God saying to you, but I would never say, well, I picture that God would use a sentence that involves the word whoredom three different times. And immediately, from the very first words of God, in verse 2 of this book of 14 chapters, I have a confession to make. I'm not really comfortable with God's language about women. I have never used the word whoredom in reference to the actions of a woman as God used 2,500 years ago when God spoke to Hosea. So right off the bat, I'm already uncomfortable with what God is telling Hosea, and I'm not uncomfortable for the right reasons. I'm uncomfortable for all the wrong reasons. But as we keep reading, we realize that things get worse because God continues to speak to Hosea after verse 3. In verse 3, we read, "So Hosea went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to Hosea, 'Name your son Jezreel. For in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel.'" Now, at this point, I hear these words and I say, really? We're going to name a baby boy after the blood that was spilled at Jezreel so that we'll remember that God will put an end to Israel? And we hope that things will get better. And in verse 6, we read that Gomer conceived again and bore a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, oh no, God's going to name this baby girl. God says to Hosea, "Name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have pity on the house of Israel or forgive them, but I will have pity on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen." And it's here that I read the words of God naming this baby Lo-Ruhamah. And I think to myself, this is a baby child and you want her to bear the name God won't save us? That seems rather cruel, doesn't it, God? And while that question still echoes around in our minds, in verse 8 we read that Gomer had weaned Lo-Ruhamah and she conceived and bore a son. Then the Lord said, "Name your thirdborn Lo-Ami, for you are not my people and I am not your God." And God asks Hosea to name this baby boy, this innocent baby boy, "God is not God of us." From Jezreel to Lo-Ruhamah to Lo-Ami, God names three babies three different things to commemorate three different events that are all terrible experiences. And it's here at the end of verse 9 that I have a second confession to make. This second confession is that I'm also not really comfortable with God's ability to name children. I mean, why didn't God pick names like Mike or Steve or Kyle or John or Mary? I mean, just pick a name, God. This isn't that hard. And yet you've somehow screwed up naming three different babies. So it's important for us to note that we are reading Hosea and we're 9 verses in, and I already have 2 confessions to make as a pastor about God's language toward women and God's ability to name children. And we're starting this series in Hosea, and if you are thinking to yourself, why are we studying this book? I would tell you that's a great question, because we're going to try our best to answer it today, because it's important for us to understand why God would name these kids these horrible things and why Hosea would write that down. Now, we also have to talk about Hosea's language toward women, but that's much more complicated to understand than these terrible names. So during this teaching, we're going to talk about the history and the context of Hosea that eventually led to these 3 terrible baby names. Then next week on the podcast, we're going to talk about Hosea's language toward women. So I promise we're going to talk about it, but it's such a big, important topic that it deserves its own podcast. And in that podcast, we're going to reference the history that we'll talk about today often. So just know that if I seem like I'm glossing over or ignoring the language toward women, I am, because we're going to discuss it next week. Then after that, on March 17 at Paradox, we'll talk about Hosea and hope. And then on March 24, we'll talk about Hosea and guns. And you may say, why are you talking about guns? The answer is because I like to give podcasts and sermons that everybody agrees on. So that's why we're going to talk about guns. Anyways, let's talk about Hosea and history. We read in Hosea 1:1 these words, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, in the days of King Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah of Judah, in the days of King Jeroboam, son of Joash of Israel." Now, if you're like me, you read through those names as quickly as you can because they mean nothing to you. But it's important for us to understand that these names meant a lot to Hosea. In fact, Hosea puts this at the beginning of his writing because he wants the reader to understand he is writing about a specific time and specific events. And so these kings and their reigns date and put context to the words that are about to follow in the book of Hosea. And so if we don't do the work and due diligence of figuring out who these kings are and what was going on in Israel during their reigns, then we'll miss the entire point of Hosea. So we must know who King Jeroboam, son of Joash of Israel, was. Otherwise, we would miss the point of Hosea entirely. So to understand Jeroboam, we have to talk about all of the kings of Israel. And over the next 15 to 20 minutes, I'm going to go through 300 years of royal Israelite history, because it is essential to understanding what Hosea wrote about. So Israel's first king was a man named Saul, and he ruled sometime around the 12th or 13th century BCE, and he was the one who united the kingdom of Israel. Unfortunately, Saul's reign, Saul's lineage, did not last very long. In fact, his son Jonathan did not inherit the throne due to a violent overthrow by a man named David, who is adored by the Christian community. I do not share this adoration personally. When people ask me, why don't you like David? Well, David used his position of power to force another man's wife to sleep with him. She became pregnant, so he tried to cover it up, and when it became obvious he could not cover it up, he had this woman's husband killed, and then he married her. Which is a bit of an ethical shortcoming, if you will. So I'm not a huge fan of David, but a lot of people are, and we can just agree to disagree on that. But David had a son named Solomon with that wife that he stole. And Solomon expanded Israel, according to the Bible, more than any other king in all the history of the Israelite kings. So under Solomon, the nation of Israel saw a great moment of prosperity and wealth and architecture and building and military might. But there's a problem, because it was built on the backs of slaves. And Solomon didn't just enslave other people from nations that he had conquered. Solomon enslaved his own people to build opulent temples and palaces. And so Solomon was a cruel, tyrannical dictator of a king. And when he passed away, there was great rejoicing throughout Israel because there was hopes that his son, Rehoboam, would not be a king like Solomon, but would be a good king going forward. And so the village elders went to King Rehoboam and they asked him a question. They said, Rehoboam, what kind of king will you be? And it was here that he thought about it. And after some time, he held out his little finger on his hand and he said, my little finger is bigger than my daddy's genitals. Which is one of the great lines in all of biblical history. He's basically saying, you ain't seen nothing yet. You thought my father was cruel. I am going to be much more cruel. And that line about his little finger and his daddy's genitals ended up splitting the kingdom because the rest of the kingdom heard this. They said, we're not going to support a tyrannical king anymore. And a man named Jeroboam, of no relation to Rehoboam, began to bring people together in the north, and they heard that Rehoboam was going to be king, and he basically said, nah, we're not going to do that. And Jeroboam splits the kingdom in two, and so there is a kingdom to the north known as Israel, and there's a kingdom to the south known as Judah. Now, the kingdom of Israel is ruled by Jeroboam and the rebellious faction of Israel, and the kingdom to the south is ruled by Rehoboam, the little finger guy that is Solomon's son. Now, Hosea tracks the history of the northern kingdom of Israel. So we're going to ignore most of the heritage and the history of the southern kingdom as we talk about the rest of the kings all the way up until Hosea's time. And so Jeroboam, who is not David's lineage, remember, starts a new kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, and he has a son named Nadab. Now, Nadab becomes king after Jeroboam dies. And after about 2 years, the people of Israel look at this king and they say he's terrible. And Nadab's own military general, a man named Baasha, decides to kill Nadab and take over the throne. Now, Baasha is a much more loved king than Nadab, even though he had to murder his way to the throne. But Baasha eventually dies and his son, Elah, takes over the throne. And after about 2 years, the people of Israel realize that Baasha's son, Elah, can't rule. So Elah's military general, a man named Zimri, overthrows the throne, kills Elah, and Zimri assumes that he's going to be the king of Israel. But the people of Israel are like, Zimri's not a great king. And so they go to another military general, a man named Omri, and they ask him to overthrow Zimri. Zimri understands he doesn't have the support of the people, so he's going to die anyways. And Zimri commits suicide by lighting his own house on fire, giving the throne to Omri. Omri then becomes king of Israel. Omri has a son named Ahab. Ahab becomes king of Israel. Ahab is famous because a man named Elijah, who was a self-proclaimed prophet of God. And Elijah looks at this king and basically says, nope, not going to do that. And he goes and challenges Ahab in a very famous showdown, one of the most famous stories in biblical history, on Mount Carmel, where he takes on the prophets of Baal, and God sends fire to bless Elijah's sacrifice, showing that God is on Elijah's side, according to the biblical author. But even after that showdown, Ahab continues to be king, even though he's hated by Elijah. Eventually, though, Ahab dies and his son Joram takes the throne. And Joram is threatened by a nation from the east, a nation named Aram. And so Joram goes to the southern king of Judah. Remember, they split because of Rehoboam. Joram goes to the southern king and says, I need some help. Will you go to war with me to fight against Aram? And Judah responds, yes, we will. We're afraid of Aram as well. And so Judah and Israel and these two kings of this divided kingdom decide to ally against Aram. And it's the closest that Israel gets to being a reunified nation. Unfortunately, what happens is Elisha, who is Elijah's protege, gets involved, and he doesn't like King Joram because his mentor, Elijah, did not like King Ahab. And so Elijah told Elisha, the people on the throne of Israel are terrible people. And so while this nation is about to be reunified, Elisha comes in, and he believes that God is asking him to anoint someone else to be king of Israel, even though Israel already has a king named Joram. And so Elisha goes to a man named Jehu, and he says, Jehu, you are supposed to be king of Israel, even though there's already a king on the throne. So Elisha anoints Jehu, which is a major act of treason, and says, now go and earn your place on the throne. So Jehu goes to both of these kings at a place called Jezreel, and he confronts both of these kings. They see Jehu there, and both kings of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, Joram and a man named Ahaz, march out to meet Jehu. Jehu talks to them for a bit and then says, prepare to die. He shoots an arrow and kills Joram, and then he shoots another arrow and kills Ahaz at this confrontational scene. He then climbs the tower at Jezreel, finds Joram's mother, a woman named Jezebel, throws her off the tower, and 2 Kings records that her blood splattered high against the tower walls, and the dogs ate her carcass. I mean, it's a pretty gruesome scene at Jezreel. Jehu then finds anyone who's related to Ahab in the north, and he kills all of them because he doesn't want any kind of insurrection against his throne. Then a few days later, he travels south and he finds relatives of the house of Ahaz, the king of the southern kingdom, and he kills all of them as well. He then kills all the prophets of Baal, and there's just all of this massive amounts of bloodshed, and it's here that Elisha shows up in the midst of this bloodshed with a word from the Lord. And it's here that Elisha goes to Jehu after he's killed, I mean, just dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of people. And Elisha says, God has something he'd like to say to you. And I'm going to say what God wants to say. And it's here in 2 Kings 10 that Elisha says, God says these words, Jehu, because you have done well in carrying out what I consider right, and in accordance with all that was in my heart, have dealt with the house of Ahab. Your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. Now, what's interesting is that if you contrast these words with what Hosea said in the passage we read at the very beginning of this podcast, God asked Hosea to name his first son Jezreel, the place where that tower was, where the blood was spilled of Joram and Ahaz and Jezebel as she was thrown off a tower and eaten by the dogs. In Hosea 1:4, God says to Hosea, name your son Jezreel, for in a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. So understand what's going on here, because I think a lot of people miss this. Imagine if we could have on this podcast as two guests, the prophet Elisha and the prophet Hosea. Now, these two people lived about 150 to 200 years apart. And if we could have them on the podcast, we'd both give them a microphone and we'd ask them one question. Did God speak to you clearly and directly? And I believe that Elisha and Hosea on this podcast would respond with one word. Yes. They'd both have the same response. God, the God of all, Yahweh, spoke to me personally, and I heard it clearly. Yes, God spoke to me. Then after that, I would ask them a second question. What did God say to you? To which Elisha would say, Jehu rocks. And Hosea would say, Jehu sucks. Two completely different messages from the same God. Now, this story is incredibly important because a lot of people miss this unless they're somehow studying 2 Kings and Hosea together. And when you look at the prophets of God, one thing that we have in our mind is this idea that when God speaks with such clarity that everyone agrees what God is saying. But here you have two self-proclaimed prophets of God, and they believe that God is telling them two very opposite things. And the reason we study this is so that we may know that biblical prophets often disagreed with each other on what God was telling them. Now, this may appear to be threatening to you, but I'm telling you, this isn't threatening. It's actually what the Bible is. And we have this idea that inspiration, which is important to Scripture, inspiration is where God speaks clearly and directly, and the Bible is exactly how God would put it together. But the reality is that human beings heard and tried to perceive and understand God in their own context, and they wrote that perception and understanding down. And sometimes those perceptions and understandings challenge what was already a perception and understanding of the current religious culture. And so when we study the Bible, we can still use the word inspiration, but I think the story of Elisha and Hosea and Jehu challenges how we define that word. And that word is important for all of us to look at the definition for. So let's remember that biblical prophets often disagree with each other on what God was telling them. Which brings us back to our story. So Jehu is now the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. And it is while Jehu is reigning that all of a sudden a nation begins to rise to the north, a nation known as Assyria. Now, the great part about Assyria is there's lots of archaeology about Assyria. And one incredible artifact is the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III, which is dated to the 9th century BCE. On this black obelisk, which can be found in the British Museum, which, let's face it, the British stole everybody's artifacts, including vibranium from Wakanda. Anyways, at the British Museum, if you go see the black obelisk of Shalmaneser, you will come across a picture of someone bowing before the king of Assyria. And when you read the inscription on this black obelisk, it cites that the person who is bowing before the king of Assyria is King Jehu of Israel. I personally find this incredibly inspiring for this reason. This is the first and earliest record of a biblical character existing outside of the biblical record. So in other words, when you look at all the extra biblical references and archaeology and history of other tribes, this is the first time that someone is named that is also found within scripture. And the earliest record we have of any king outside of the Bible is of King Jehu bowing before Assyria. And it shows that as this power rose to the north, Jehu did not oppose it, but submitted to it. So Jehu leads the nation of Israel into submission from the northern neighbors of Assyria. And this submission is continued with a man named Jehoahaz. And while Jehoahaz becomes king, that nation to the east, the nation known as Aram, decides to attack Jehoahaz. And Jehoahaz cries out for help, hoping that the southern kingdom of Judah will come to their aid. But Judah looks to the north that is being attacked by Aram, and it's ruled by a man named Jehoahaz, who is the son of Jehu. And if you remember, Jehu killed Judah's king, which is still pretty fresh in their mind. So while the northern kingdom of Israel is calling out for help, Judah's like, no, we're not going to help. And it is there that Assyria gets involved and says, sure, we'll help Israel fight the Aramaeans. And they are able to repel the Aramaeans with the northern kingdom of Israel. And this battle extends into Jehoahaz's son, Jehoash, who is the grandson of Jehu. Now, as soon as Assyria becomes allies with the northern kingdom of Israel and they are able to repel the Aramaeans, this is when the southern kingdom of Judah is like, oh my goodness, we should be friends with Israel before they come and destroy us. So they go to the northern kingdom and they say, we should be friends now. And the northern kingdom is like, nope, you had your chance, you missed it. And in response, Israel attacks the southern kingdom of Judah. Jehoash launches a civil war on his own relatives in the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, Jehoash has a son, Jeroboam, and Jeroboam takes the throne. This is the great grandson of Jehu, and he expands Israel to the height of its powers before things unravel rather quickly. Now, if the name Jeroboam sounds familiar, there are two reasons. The first one is the first king who started the nation of Israel and separated it from the southern kingdom of Judah was a man named Jeroboam as well. Understand that this Jeroboam, the great grandson of Jehu, is not related to that Jeroboam. There's been too many violent overthrows for that to be the case. But Jeroboam should also sound familiar because this is the king that Hosea cites as on the throne at the beginning of Hosea's written work. We read in Hosea 1:1, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, in the days of King Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah of Judah, and in the days of King Jeroboam, son of Joash of Israel. And it's here, under this reign, that Hosea begins to write, and things get crazy rather quickly. Because Jeroboam has a son named Zechariah, and when Jeroboam dies, Zechariah reigns for 6 months before a man named Shallum decides to murder him and take the throne. Now, what's interesting about Shallum is that his whole platform and the reason he murdered Zechariah was because he said, down with Assyria. We shouldn't be allies with Assyria, even though they helped us in our hour of need. Now, Assyria hears that Shalom is not excited about Israel being allied with Assyria. And so Assyria responds by saying, let's attack Israel. And so they launch a full-scale attack on Israel. And Shalom reigns for a month before a man named Menahem says, enough of this. We're going to die to the Assyrians. And Menahem assumes the throne. He says, hey, Assyria, we're really sorry that this last guy said, down with Assyria. Here, we like Assyria now. You can, in fact, take all of our money and return to Assyria as an apology gift because we feel really bad about that confusion. So Assyria gladly takes all of Israel's money. And Assyria then returns back to their homeland. And Menahem says, whatever we do, we've got to maintain this alliance with Assyria. So Menahem reigned for about 20 years, and his whole platform was, whatever we do, we just got to be friendly to the Assyrians, otherwise they'll crush us. Menahem has a son named Pekahiah. Pekahiah takes over the throne when his father dies, and Pekahiah reigns for about 2 years before a man named Pekah kills him and takes over the throne, and his whole platform is, down with Assyria. And in order to prove that he needs to be down with Assyria, he begins to ally with Aram. Yes, the same Aram that attacked Israel not too long ago. And they decide to launch a full-scale attack on Judah because it seems a little easier to conquer Judah than Assyria. Now, Judah, in response to this attack from Israel and Aram, yells out for help. And guess who helps them? Of course, it's Assyria. And Assyria launches an attack on Israel. And it is here that this is about the beginning of the end for Israel, because Pekah then is assassinated by a man named Hoshea. And before Hoshea takes over the throne is when Hosea stops writing. Now, this is important for us to understand, because from the time of Jeroboam to Pekah and all of those violent overthrows and the question of whether or not we should be allied with Assyria or not, Hosea is writing, and the thesis of his writing and the thesis of this entire book is this: Israel must break their alliance with Assyria and return to God. So when Shalom murders Zechariah, Hosea would have said, well done. That's what I'm talking about. When Pekah murdered Pekahiah, Hosea would have applauded that and said, it is divine intervention, because this whole alliance with Assyria will eventually lead to our destruction. And so when we read the writings of Hosea, it's important for us to understand just how tumultuous the political landscape of his life and of his country were. It was in a terrible state of disarray where people were murdering and everybody was trying to figure out whether or not they should have this foreign alliance with the nation of Assyria. Now, there's a couple of thoughts here that we must remember before we go forward. The first one is this: whenever somebody says religion shouldn't be political, ask them if they've ever read the book of Hosea. Because it's all about whether or not a government should be an ally with a foreign power or not. And according to Hosea, he says, definitely not this foreign power. The second thing that we have to come to an understanding on is that Hosea was living during a very frightening, terrible, violent time. And so when Hosea writes during that frightening, terrible, horrible time, he writes with violent, terrible, horrible language. And it's important that we understand that Hosea writes with intense, urgent language because he is in an intense and urgent situation. And so if God appears angry over these 14 chapters, it's because Hosea is living at a time where he's convinced that God is angry. And so when we talk about these three baby names, Jezreel, Lo-Ruhamah, and Lo-Ami, and how terrible they are, and we're to say, like, really, why, Hosea, why can't you just talk about how God is merciful? He would almost respond with this: I haven't found that God is merciful at all. Instead, God is angry with us because we are allied with this foreign power, and it will eventually lead to our destruction. Now, here's what's interesting. After Hosea stops writing, he eventually dies. And Hoshea is on the throne, and he's saying that Assyria is great. He's murdered Pekah before him. And he's like, look, I'm really sorry about what the previous guy said, but we want you to know, Assyria, that we like you. And Assyria hears this, and they say no. And they march on Israel. They've had enough of Israel. And in 722 BCE, they wipe Israel off the map. Assyria destroys Israel in 722. And what this means is simply this. Hosea was right. He called it. In his writing, he said, our alliance with Assyria will eventually lead to our destruction. And wouldn't you know it, in 722 BCE, that's exactly what happened. Now, that is not the end of the story of Hosea. Because 136 years after the destruction of Israel, Judah is still hanging on. Judah is there, but they are hanging on by a thread in 586 BCE, and they are surrounded by three global military superpowers that are just breathing down their neck. To the north is Assyria, to the east is Babylon, and to the south is Egypt. And in 586 BCE, it's almost like there's this question within Judah, that southern kingdom that still has one of David's descendants on the throne. There's this question about whether or not they will survive and who will lead to their destruction. And in 586 BCE, Babylon marches on Jerusalem. They capture Jerusalem. They destroy Judah. And they take any survivors they can find back across the desert and force them to live in Babylon. And the hope of the Babylonians is that the people of Judah, the Jews, will intermarry with the Babylonians. And the people of Judah will forget their history and become Babylonian. Now, this event is called the exile, and it's here in Babylon that we have to understand the exile, which lasted from 586 to 539, that this exile is the most important event in the Hebrew Bible. Now, you can say, those are big words, Craig. What about creation? What about the Exodus? What about the flood? I would respond, yes, I know about all those things, and I think the exile is more important because it was here in Babylon that the people of Judah displaced and being forced to give up their racial identity and their national identity began to ask two very important questions. The first question is this: can we still worship God without a temple? Now, this may seem like an obvious answer to you, but throughout Judah's history, there was this sense that if they built a temple, God would be in that temple, and that temple was the reminder that God was with them. And this was passed down from generation to generation to generation, and it was practiced here at the temple, this book called Leviticus, which told people how to be at peace with God. And if you take away that temple, then you no longer have a way to be at peace with God, and you no longer have the presence of God among you. So it is here in Babylon, in exile, that the people of Judah began to ask the question, can we still worship God without a temple? And the answer came back, yes. And while the answer came back, yes, another question arose, which was, well, how can we still worship God if we don't have a temple? And it's here that people in exile began to tell these stories, these oral traditions, and instead of just passing them down orally, they instead began to write them down. And it's here that they start putting writings together, like books like Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and the prophets. And while it was far from complete, and while very few people would call it the Bible, they called it the Word. And this Word, this collection of different authors over multiple generations, began to sit next to each other for the very first time. And about 400 years after this, it would be voted together to be the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians call the Old Testament. So the reason the exile is so important and the most important event in Hebrew Bible history is because it is the background story for almost all of the books that are written in the Hebrew Bible. And the reason that Genesis is in our Bible is because people who were in exile were like, yeah, we really believe in a God who created a good universe, even though we're caught in the middle of exile. And they also loved the story about God liberating people who were oppressed and living in slavery, because they looked around at Babylon and they said, well, we're kind of in the same thing. And so while they had that story beforehand, they began to write it down and reproduce it, because all of a sudden it took on a new layer of meaning. And whenever we read most of the Hebrew Bible, the exile is the story that shaped and framed and gave voice to the stories that are in the Bible that we read today? So that's the first question. The second question, and this is also equally important, is there was this theological question that arose because the people of Judah believed that their God was all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing, and could have stopped any kind of suffering if God wanted to. So while they are in Babylon, while they are exiled in Babylon, there's this question that arose, and it's not a quiet question, it is a major theological question. Why? Why did this exile happen to us? Why didn't God do something and help us out? And so when they're looking back at their history in 586 BCE, this split of the nation where Judah and Israel split is very much a part of their history. And everybody knows about the Assyrian destruction of Israel in 722. So 136 years later, they're asking this question. They're looking back at their history and they're asking the question, why didn't God protect Israel from Assyria? Why didn't God do something? Why didn't God hear the prayers of the people of Israel and defend Israel against Assyria? And it was here in Babylon that they're looking back at this history and they say, oh, there was this guy named Hosea who wrote something about this. Hosea tried to warn everybody that if they kept up this alliance with Assyria, it would lead to their destruction, and that's what happened. We should include that writing because Hosea was desperate to get Israel to abandon the alliance with Assyria and return to God. And so Hosea's writing helps us understand what happened and why this exile happened to us. Now, it's very important for us to understand that in 586 BCE to 539 BCE is when Hosea's writing goes from being mere words on a page to being part of a collection of writings that would eventually become the Hebrew Bible. And because people made that decision all the way back in Babylon 2,500 years ago, and that decision was affirmed about 400 years later by Jews living in the Hasmonean dynasty, and then affirmed again about 500 years after that by a council in Carthage in modern-day Tunisia that said we will include the Hebrew Bible in the Christian Bible, which was then translated and passed down from generation to generation until we have arrived with these words in Hosea 1:1-9 all the way in 2018. And we read these words and we say, God can't name kids and God is offensive to women, which raises the question, who cares if it's here? Is it actually helpful? Can we learn anything from Hosea? Why on earth are we studying Hosea in 2018? Because it doesn't seem very helpful to us. And I want you to know I understand that concern, but I will tell you there are three major reasons why it's helpful to study Hosea in 2018. The first reason is this. When we look through the history of Israel and 300 years of king, and this guy murdered this guy, and this guy succeeded this guy, and this guy didn't trust this guy, and this guy hated Assyria, and this guy loved Assyria. It all seems very human, doesn't it? And what's interesting is this humanity is very intense, frightening, violent, fearful humanity. And into this moment comes a prophet named Hosea, and Hosea is a religious man. And in this religion, Hosea is told that God is merciful and that God is all powerful and that God's all knowing and that God will take care of you as long as you trust God. And Hosea looks around at his reality with Assyria breathing down the neck of the Israelites. And he hears all of the religious chatter and he responds by writing this work. And in this work, he talks about how God isn't merciful, how God's love isn't unconditional, but rather conditional. How we are no longer God's people and God has abandoned us and how God has left us here to die. None of those things that Hosea said plays well in a church today. And yet here he is 2,500 years ago, 2,700 years ago, saying, I'm not sure all those promises about faith are actually true. Hosea then dies. Assyria conquers Israel. Babylon conquers Judah. And there's people living in Babylon, the people of Judah are living in Babylon, and they read Hosea's words. They're saying, God has abandoned us, and they're not threatened by it. They're not angry about his words. Instead, they say, oh, those words are valuable, and they use one word to describe what Hosea's written words are. The word they chose was holy. Hosea's words are holy. And even though Hosea is rejecting what religion has handed him, what he is saying is in fact holy. So when people ask me, why do we study Hosea in 2018? Because Hosea and its inclusion with Scripture, within Scripture, reminds us that lament and grief and honesty and questioning our religion and doubt are all holy. Anytime you use the word holy Bible, you are affirming this, because you are saying that Hosea's words, when Hosea says that God wasn't there for us, God wasn't merciful, God left us here to die. When you say holy Bible, you're saying, yeah, that's part of it. And yes, there are moments when God comes through and it's obvious, and there are moments of beautiful love and happiness within this life. But there are also those moments where it doesn't seem like God cares. And we as Christians should never be threatened when someone says, let me tell you that what I found to be true about God, that God doesn't really care about me. Rather than rushing in and saying, shh, don't talk that way, that's not who God is, we hear those words and we say, oh, these are holy words, and they are every bit as necessary and valuable as the celebrations and good words about God. So lament, grief, honesty, and doubt are holy. Which brings us to the second reason we study the works of Hosea. Now, to talk about this second reason, I need to talk about the three different kinds of suffering. The first kind of suffering is called explicable suffering. Now, explicable suffering happens when there's a clear cause and a clear effect. For instance, when someone smokes 2 packs a day and they contract lung cancer, very few people shake their fists to the heavens and say, God, why did this happen to me? In other words, this is suffering that is real suffering, but with an explanation. And people are eventually saying, when they see explicable suffering, they say to themselves, well, this was entirely preventable. On the other side, there is also inexplicable suffering. And inexplicable suffering happens when someone who never smokes a day in their life contracts lung cancer. It's almost like you can be in the doctor's room with that person when the doctor says, I'm sorry, you have lung cancer. And the person responds by saying, but I've never smoked a day in my life. And it's here that the doctor almost says, well, nothing you could have done could have prevented this. It's just the way that diseases sometimes occur. And so there is inexplicable suffering on the other side of explicable suffering. Now, these two forms of suffering are rather rare, because most suffering happens in between these two, which is a combination of explicable and inexplicable suffering. The reason human beings ask the question why when we suffer is because we are trying to figure out if any part of our suffering was in fact preventable. And so whenever a human being starts to ask why, when another human being says, no, don't ask why, you'll never get an answer, don't do that, because you are denying this person who is grieving the ability to grieve with it in a human way. Now, I bring all this up because a lot of this helps us understand what Hosea went through. Because Hosea saw Assyria to the north breathing down the neck of Israel, and he saw what was coming, and he said, there's about to be a whole lot of suffering. There already is a lot of suffering in Israel's history, but it's about to get worse, and I want everyone to know that I can explain this. We can prevent our destruction if we abandon this alliance with Assyria, and if we stay allies with Assyria, then guess what? We will be in for a world of hurt. And so Hosea then begins to write that if they don't listen to him, if the people of Israel don't listen to Hosea, then they will pretty much deserve the pain and the suffering they have gone through. And if the people of Israel choose to ignore this prophet and continue in their alliance with Assyria, then God will be very angry because they had a chance to prevent this and they chose not to. And so God has no choice but to leave them there to die. And when we read the book of Hosea, there is a bitterness and a callousness that almost feels like Hosea is indifferent to the people of Israel if they don't heed his warning. This is important because what I found with Christians is that they fall subject to the same temptation that Hosea fell to long ago. When we can explain suffering, there is a real human temptation to be apathetic toward those in pain rather than compassionate. I have seen Christians who have turned their backs on smokers who contract lung cancer because they say, "Well, why didn't you listen to me before?" But you and me, my brothers and sisters, as Christians, are not called to be right. Jesus called us to be compassionate. And compassionate people suffer alongside those in pain, whether or not they could have prevented it. And this temptation that whenever we can explain someone's suffering and identify a clear cause and a clear effect, we look at them with crossed arms and we say, "Well, you pretty much deserve this, didn't you?" And that's exactly what Hosea did. And it's exactly what Christians do today. And yet Jesus Christ calls us to avoid that temptation and choose compassion instead. Which brings us to the third reason we study Hosea. Hosea was in the midst of a nation in turmoil, surrounded by global military superpowers hanging on by a thread. And it is in the midst of this suffering and uncertainty that he looks toward the heavens and asks a daunting question that shapes all of his writing of Hosea. The question is this: why isn't God doing something about this? Why isn't God intervening and doing something about our pain? 136 years after Assyria destroys Israel, there is a group of people huddled together in Babylon, and they have a question on their minds. Why isn't God doing something about this? For 100 years after Babylon, there is a group of Jews surrounded by the Greek Empire during the Hasmonean dynasty that is surrounded by this military superpower, and they are asking themselves a question. Why isn't God doing something about this? And it's here that I'd like for you to think about your own life. Because what we did at Paradox on Saturday was I then asked the congregation, I said, if any of you have ever suffered, and it was suffering that was so blinding, so debilitating, so hard to endure, that you looked toward the heavens and you asked the question, why aren't you doing something about this, God? Would you please stand at this time? And it was at that moment that everyone in Paradox stood. And I said to them, look, I believe that if Hosea was with us today, he would be standing with you. And the reason we study Hosea is to remind us that we are not alone. You are not the first person to ask this question. Not only that, but you are not at odds with God when you ask this question. In fact, you are in the heart of the tradition when you ask this question, because this question, why aren't you doing something, God, is the heartbeat of what shaped the entire Bible. And pain has a tendency to isolate us, to make us feel like we are alone, but it is in that moment that we are not alone, that we are standing side by side with Hosea, who was deemed worthy enough to write scripture, and that we are standing in the heart of the tradition and we are doing exactly what God would have us do. We are not alone as we wonder why God has not intervened to prevent our suffering. And so, my brothers and sisters, may we continue to study Hosea. And as we look at this history and these words and this idea that was shared so long ago, may we remember that lament, grief, doubt, and honesty are all holy. May we remember that when we can explain suffering, there is a real temptation to be apathetic towards someone who's in pain. And instead, may we choose compassion over apathy. And lastly, when we suffer, And when we ask the question, God, where are you? Why haven't you helped me? It is in that moment that you are not alone. You are not against the tradition, but you stand in line with the prophets, and specifically the prophet Hosea. May you see and embrace the inspiration in all.